This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. Imagine a limo picks you up, whisk you away to a top hospital with top physicians. You stay in a beautiful suite with superb food, courteous, attentive staff. The doctor spends time with you explaining the procedure, answering your questions, and gives you his phone number and cell phone number. Sound like treatment that only the super rich get? Not necessarily. Dozens of countries are offering top-notch medical treatments with top-notch physicians and plush amenities for a fraction of what it costs in the U.S. Millions of Americans and people from other countries are getting major dental work, cosmetic surgery, hip replacements, and other surgeries and treatments while taking a vacation in countries like Thailand, Singapore, Panama, India, and Malaysia. And often it costs less for the treatment and vacation put together than it would for the treatment alone in the U.S. The expert on medical tourism is Dr. Paul Gallinger, author of The Medical Tourism Travel Guide. Before he became an MD, Dr. Gallinger had a PhD in medical anthropology and a master's degree in public health. He's worked in dozens of countries, traveled to 120 countries, which is just about all of them. He's worked as a physician in Antarctica, and was a bioastronautical consultant to NASA. I think when space travel opens up, we're probably going to see Dr. Gallinger in space as well. Dr. Gallinger, what type of numbers are we talking about, and how many of these people are Americans and how many from other countries?
Well, at this point, medical tourism is a relatively new phenomenon for the United States. I think we're seeing just a few thousand people right now, but it's growing very rapidly. In Europe, it's been much more popular. There have been tens of thousands of people in Europe and around the world who have been traveling to other countries for their health care.
And you said India alone is getting 2 million tourists a year?
Some estimates put it at that. India, of course, is one of the major players in medical tourism. They're building dozens of brand new hospitals that are absolutely state-of-the-art billion-dollar medical facilities. People have traveled there from Europe and from the Middle East for a long time, so medical tourism has been a big part of the economy and is scheduled to be an even bigger part of it.
Now, I read your book, and rationally, I think it's fantastic, but we're so used to hearing that the best medical care is in the U.S. that part of me still finds it hard to believe. So I'd like to start with some of the believability concerns. For example, I think of Thailand as a very poor country. How does a country like Thailand develop top facilities?
Well, that's the irony in some ways. And there has been a lot of discussion on that. One of the reasons that they can develop top facilities is because the cost of doing so is quite a bit lower for them. So labor in a country like Thailand or India is much, much cheaper than it is, say, in the United States. And that's why if you go to a hospital in Thailand, they'll have literally thousands of nurses, completely qualified nurses, and patients typically have one-on-one nursing care. That means you have your own private nurse 24/7. And they do much more than an American nurse must because they don't have all the paperwork to do. So they literally wait on you hand and foot, take care of you completely, give you massages, bring you a coffee from Starbucks, that kind of thing. Yeah, they have Starbucks there even. They're everywhere pretty much. I'm sure as soon as they build a moon base, there'll be a Starbucks there within days. So labor's a lot cheaper there. Building a hospital there is a lot cheaper. Pretty much everything is cheaper. But that doesn't mean that the quality is any less. These hospitals are built specifically for foreigners, so they are top quality.
We're so used to waiting half an hour for the nurse or the aide to come. It's just hard to believe that you can really get this kind of attention.
It's amazing. People I've talked to, and I've visited quite a number of these hospitals, talked to many of the patients and the staff. The patients just can't believe it. They say, I am never setting foot in another American hospital after being treated there.
Now, you say that the doctors are often better than the typical doctors in the United States. How do you get top-notch doctors to work in these countries for probably a fraction of what they could earn in the United States? Aren't they still paying off their loans for their college education?
Well, I don't think they're paying off their loans anymore. I did speak to a surgeon who is a very highly regarded surgeon, and this was in New Delhi in India. And he had been making, I think, $2 or $3 million a year in Manhattan in New York. But he was a heart surgeon and a very, very prominent one. And he moved back to India, where he was making only about $100,000. But in India, that's a lot of money. And he moved back because he said, you know, it just wasn't worth it. I mean, I was heading to a heart attack myself living in Manhattan. So he gave up his multi-million dollar salary because he was at home, he had his family, their extended family, his community, the neighborhood, and the salary he made was still much more than enough to live really well. So we have this phenomenon of people who are very highly qualified choosing to move back home because that is, after all, they're from and where their families are.
Well, and from what you said earlier, one of the attractions is probably not having to fool with the insurance companies and having the nursing support and staff support.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they don't have any of the headaches that doctors do in the United States. Let's look at a typical situation. People think, well, I don't really want to go to India because I'll see an Indian doctor. They're not really going to understand me as well. It's a different culture. But think about it. When you go to a hospital here, first off, the irony is you'll probably see someone from India. Certainly in New York, 60% of the physicians are from overseas. So you know, that's a little ironic right there. But the second thing is that when you go to a hospital here, you'll see physician, right? And you don't really know if it's the best physician or somebody just managed to skate by, get the degree. Because, you know, typically you don't really know the academic background of every physician who's treating you. And a lot of them might even be residents still in training.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you go overseas, you don't see a regular doctor. You see the very best. And they're typically people who have trained in the United States at top facilities. So, for example, if you go to the Max Devi Heart Institute in India, their surgeons and their cardiologists are people who have trained at Harvard and Johns Hopkins and Stanford. So you'll get the very best there.
You've reviewed a lot of these facilities and made some decisions about which ones really do meet good standards and which ones to avoid. What kind of a process did you go through in deciding who to approve or endorse?
Well, it was a difficult thing because I didn't want to actually endorse facilities. But on the other hand, I did want to point out that there are some ways where people can look into quality. That's improving now as it's becoming a bigger phenomenon. But certainly, the key indicator of quality would be JCI accreditation. And JCI stands for the Joint Commission International, and it is the international version of the Joint Commission in the United States, often referred to as called JCO because of acronym, the way it's spelled. But JCI accreditation is very, very difficult to get, and it means a hospital has to be literally top quality. Now, there aren't very many of those around the world. But those are the places I would recommend people go to. And there are a number of those in Singapore, Thailand, a few in Malaysia, quite a few in India, and increasingly in other countries.
So if it has that, do you still need to look at the qualifications of the doctors, or can you...
No, they would cover that. If they have that, you can be assured you're getting top quality care. Now, you can still look at the individual physicians, and that's another thing. When people travel to these countries, if they get in touch with the hospitals directly, they could speak to their surgeons before they go and learn more about them. And, you know, that's often even difficult to do in the United States.
Certainly is. And you're suggesting that the vast majority of these physicians are very proficient in English.
Absolutely. That hasn't been a problem.
Matter of fact, did most of them train in the United States?
I would say most of them did train in the U.S., and we're talking about countries. We're not talking really about third-world institutions. You know, we're talking about places in Singapore, where virtually everyone speaks English, India, where just about anyone who's educated speaks English. In Thailand, most of the physicians have trained in the U.S. That goes back a long ways. It goes back about 100 years when the king of Thailand actually trained to be a medical doctor at Harvard. So that started off a trend with the royal family going to the United States for graduate school. And, of course, there have been many connections with the U.S. and with Thailand with their medical services.
There's still a skeptic in me that says, I hear all the time about Saudi princes coming to the United States to get treatment and other elite from the Middle East. Why wouldn't they go to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates or Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, where it's an Arab culture and they're closer to home?
Well, they are. Facilities in Dubai are brand new. So certainly in the past they would have come to the United States, and maybe they still do. Surely they're not so much worried about the cost, and that's one reason people travel overseas, is to get discounted procedures. But they are definitely going to places in Dubai, and when you travel to Thailand, to some of the hospitals in Bangkok, you see plenty of people in Arabic dress, even women completely covered head to toe, and other people coming from those countries.
What kind of data are there comparing the surgical outcomes and complications in the U.S. versus abroad?
You know, it's an interesting question, because in the U.S., in order to have the Joint Commission accreditation, you have to have quality control measures, including collecting all these data. So it's pretty straightforward. A lot of the hospitals overseas, certainly those that don't have the JCI accreditation, they may not be quite so thorough in collecting the data. But those that we do have find that they are superb. I mentioned Max Devi Heart Institute in India. I mean, that has a better outcomes measure than any American hospital. But they have far fewer adverse effects and poor outcomes and other problems.
There's also emotional fears. If you're in a foreign country and things go wrong, even if they have low problem rates, what kind of recourse do you have? You probably can't sue.
You can, but I think it would be pretty difficult. Most of those countries don't have the same malpractice tort legislation that we do in the United States. That's one reason healthcare is cheaper overseas, of course, because the physicians don't have the malpractice insurance policies. And they may also practice medicine differently because it would use less defensive measures and maybe work a little more directly with the patients and not worry so much about the lawyer who might be lurking in the background. But the bottom line is, people do worry, well, what happens? What if something goes wrong? What recourse do I have? Well, first off, these facilities overseas are really happy to have your business. They will do just about anything else to make sure that the patient is satisfied. And typically, that means that if there are any problems, they take care of it 100% and they don't charge anything. In the U.S., it would be a matter of filing a grievance and maybe a lawsuit, which can drag on for years and years. That doesn't happen overseas. They'll just meet with the patient and make sure that they're happy, because they depend on word of mouth and they depend on happy patients. I haven't really seen it be a problem, I guess.
So this is a customer is always right way of doing business?
That's the experience I've had in Thailand. I haven't actually talked to anybody who's had a horrible outcome, but I've read about it. There have been people who've gone to places in Eastern Europe, for example, where they were botched discount surgeries or dental care that turned out horrible. So it does mean that people, before they go, should do a little homework. And this is really why I wrote the book, because when I first learned about this phenomenon, I went on the internet, and there is a lot of stuff on the internet that is just not true. You know, pretty much anyone can put up a website and promise anything. And people were getting lured by these websites and ending up in really shabby places. So I thought, well, I'm going to write this book and show people how they can find a quality place and be sure that, you know, they're going to get good service.
Using the places that you talk about in your book, the chances of being brushed off if you have complications are pretty slim.
I'd say absolutely. If you go to a quality facility, that simply is not going to happen. In fact, the very first thing they'll do is say, okay, there is no fee whatsoever, it's all free, and we're going to take care of you to make sure that you're happy.
I still have some emotional fears. A lot of people go abroad and they get diarrhea or other illnesses, which is going to either complicate the procedure or mean you have to cancel it. How do you make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, most people travel overseas for health care. They're not going to be staying at some discount hotel somewhere. They're going to be staying at a resort, or they're going to be staying at some facility that is associated with the healthcare center. For example, I was at one place in Phuket where there is a resort called the Bodyline Resort. It's run by a couple of sisters, they're twins, from Australia. And they have set up this great operation where they have a really nice resort facility that is connected with all of the local hospitals. So patients are shuttled back and forth. They don't have to worry about a thing. The hospital sends the nurses right out to the resort to follow up and take care of them afterwards. And it's really a wonderful program, and we're starting to see that more and more in other countries. There's a place in Costa Rica that does that, a place in Panama, and a lot of other hospitals are actually contracting with really 4 or 5-star hotels to provide hospitality suites for their patients.
If you have a facelift, how much of a vacation can you have?
Well, clearly, with some types of surgery, you need to be out of the sun for a while. In that case, you can still go sightseeing, but after the surgery, you're going to need a period of recovery. But that's another reason why it might be nice to go overseas for that. Because at home, people are wondering why you're at home, or maybe family and friends will certainly know about your procedure. But some people prefer to go to other countries, say for going down to Panama for a facelift, where you can relax sort of anonymity, come back, and people wonder why you're looking so much younger, and they have no idea that you actually had this procedure done.
So even if you can't get out in the sun, you're not going to have the phone call interruptions, and you're going to get pampered.
You get pampered, and you're relaxed. You know what that means? That means you heal a lot faster.
Mm-hmm.
That means the outcome's a lot better.
There's an interesting contrast with the facility you described in Germany that's right in the airport, and you don't even have to go through customs to use it.
Yes, that's in Munich. That's a new phenomenon. It's very exciting. Next week, I'm actually meeting with some people from Germany who are helped to run that. It's a really interesting concept, and I think it's part of the wave of the future.
And the idea there is for people who are very time conscious and just want to get it done quickly?
I think the idea is more convenience. And as we know, in some places, it might take weeks and weeks to get an appointment to have an MRI or to have some other kind of procedure done. This way, they could just fly in, stay at a hotel, have it done, and be on their way at a lower cost and certainly at a much greater convenience. And they actually don't even have to enter the country because they're not going past the airport. Mm. So they don't even have to go through the whole business of getting a visa. Now, for us, that's not really a big deal. I mean, we can travel to Germany without any problems. But that's not true for most of the people in the world. You know, for them to go to Germany, they need to get a visa, which is a lot of paperwork.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about two kinds of procedures that are difficult or even impossible to get in the United States. One would be controversial procedures like Selatril for cancer or maybe alternative medicine procedures. But the other are cutting-edge things like hip resurfacing. Why is it so difficult to get hip resurfacing in the United States?
It's getting easier. Just a few years ago, you pretty much had to go and get it done as an experimental procedure in a place like Boston. Now it's getting more common, but Americans are slow to change. And that's partly because of the whole malpractice issue. They'd rather stay with a tried and true traditional procedure than do something new. Because if something went wrong with the new thing, you know, they're much more likely to get sued. And people don't trust things that are innovative. So a lot of the newest procedures are being developed overseas. We see this for hip resurfacing is one, and that's starting to start here. But we're especially seeing it with stem cell research. And the U.S. is now 5 years behind in stem cell work and therapies, behind countries like South Korea and Thailand.
And you wrote that there's even some politics in there, in that the manufacturers of the parts want to keep selling their parts as opposed to losing that product line, and the physicians that are good at it want to continue doing what they're good at.
You know how it is with the American medical system. It was described as the medical industrial complex, sort of a takeoff on the old phrase, the military industrial complex.
Eisenhower, yeah.
There are so many corporations and interests and special interests and politicians involved that it becomes impossible to untangle everything. Innovation becomes difficult because so many people have a vested interest in keeping things the way they are. And of course, that's where you have the advantage of going overseas, because they are not bound by those special interests.
Have you had some surgery or treatments yourself in some of these abroad facilities?
I haven't. It's interesting because other people have written about medical tourism, and virtually all of them wrote about it after having experienced it themselves. I mean, a typical case might be someone who went overseas, either had an accident and then was treated, or specifically heard about it and decided to get a treatment, thought, wow, this is fantastic. They've met other people who are doing the same thing and then decided to write about their experience. There's a woman who wrote a very popular book when she and her husband went to Delhi in India for his heart surgery. And it was more of a personal account. But my book came out of my own work in Singapore after the tsunami. I was invited to come there and consult on the reconstruction effort in Indonesia. And as you remember, that tsunami, that happened at the end of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
When I was over there, I learned a lot about the hospital system, and all the talk was about medical tourism, which was a fairly new thing to me. And I had no idea how big it was. I became interested in it and decided to do research on it, and then eventually wrote the book on the subject after traveling to a lot of these different hospitals. But it was more of an academic interest.
So a lot of the other books are more diaries and personal accounts. Yours is systematic. You've seen dozens and dozens of these facilities and interviewed hundreds of patients.
Mine is actually the only book that really looks at the industry. All of the other books are either some slapdash accounts that are put together with a few addresses, most of which are wrong and out of date, and phone numbers which are no longer in effect. You know, they're things that are fairly hurriedly put together, mainly by journalists who saw a chance of writing on something new. But mine is actually the very first book that really describes the industry, and especially the first book that describes how to go about making sure that you get quality treatment.
And brand new, copyright 2008.
That just came out in July.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Gallinger, author of The Medical Tourism Travel Guide. In a minute, we'll get back to Dr. Gallinger and learn how to avoid mistakes and why medical tourism ultimately will help U.S. medicine. First, a word from our sponsor. Do you have a burning desire to help people? Do you have an interest in health and wellness? Are you looking to change or add to your career? Become a professional health coach. The U.S. Department of Labor predicts a substantial increase in employment for fitness and health professionals. Create your own business with job security, high demand, and rapid growth. Train with experts step by step. You will learn how you can work from anywhere using $2 million internet software to build and run your coaching practice. You can work with personal clients, gyms, sports clinics, and small and large businesses. Be ready to earn an income in as little as 90 days. To get the free facts and training with no obligation, go to healthcoachtraining.com/Judith. That was healthcoachtraining.com/Judith, no spaces. There you can get your first lesson free and a guided tour of the training software. Also, listen to the live show on October 1st, 2008, and hear how Health Coach Judith has helped others. The link for that show is a little complex, so I'll put it on my website, agelesslifestyles.com. And now back to Dr. Gallinger. Dr. Gallinger has a PhD in medical anthropology, a master's degree in public health, and an MD degree. He's worked in dozens of countries and traveled in almost all the countries in the world. The book explains what medical tourism is, the process of selecting a facility, preparing to go there, and like a travel guide, it gives the skinny on dozens of top facilities around the world. And I thought one of the coolest things that you did in the book is this table in which not only do you have all the countries and all the procedures, but you put a star beside the one that they really excel in.
Yes, that was actually on the urging of my publisher. They said, look, there's just too much information here. You've got to give readers some more direction. And it's true. I mean, you can't just tell someone, well, you know, you have 2,000 different places to go to here for dental treatment. People ask me all the time, just tell me which place is best.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the answer is, well, there are a lot of really good quality places. So I usually ask them some other questions. Where would you like to go? Do you have any other reasons for going there? You know, is this a chance to mix a vacation with medical treatment?
You look at the vacation and you kind of trade off between who's best at it and where do I want to go and see where the matches are.
Sure. I mean, if you want to get cosmetic surgery, you mentioned a facelift. You can get that at 50 different countries, and I would say there are excellent services virtually everywhere. This is not a very difficult thing. It doesn't require a big hospital. It just requires a skilled cosmetic surgeon with a clinic. Now, let's say you want to combine that with a safari. Well, you could go to South Africa, and they actually have packages now that combine a safari with cosmetic surgery. Seems a little odd, but, you know, what a great package.
Mm-hmm. Do travel agents handle this?
It's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, the travel industry has gone through a radical shift. I mean, basically, the job of travel agent is history. 15 years ago, if you traveled somewhere, you typically went to the local travel agents, and they got you the ticket. They looked up online how to get it. And before that, of course, they had other methods, of usually the telephone, of trying to get you a good ticket. But now, almost nobody does that anymore. I mean, the whole job of travel agent has virtually disappeared. You still have a few, but the industry is basically gone. So some of those people decided to go into medical tourism. But, you know, they're not medical people. And they worked on the old model of getting a commission. So in the old days, a travel agent, the way they made their money is they didn't charge you anything, but they got a cut. You know, they got, say, 10%. So if they sold a cruise on a cruise ship that cost $1,500, they made $150. And that paid them for the time it took to put that package together and make all the arrangements. Well, a lot of travel agents have thought, we'll take that same model to medical tourism. So we'll get the hospitals to give us a cut, and we'll send patients over there, and we'll promise them everything, but all we're really doing is hooking them up. You know, all we're really doing is making the arrangements, none of the medical stuff. I really discourage that whole process. I think we're going through sort of a change as all this starts to develop, because a lot of travel agents jumped into that business, but they didn't really provide much service other than giving them the numbers of the hospitals to go to, the phone numbers. They would take a commission from the hospital, which means now you know, you're getting sent to whoever pays the most, right?
Right.
And that is, of course, a little scary, because that's how you end up with people who end up at some shabby facility that they paid some internet travel agent to send them to. We're going to see a big change in that. And I think that in the future, it'll probably be more medical clinics that will be involved in making the medical tourism arrangements rather than former travel agents.
So maybe the Mayo Clinic would have an office that arranges these kind of trips.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the future. It'll be interesting to see how it develops. This is such a brand new industry, and we're heading into a whole new phase of healthcare, where basically healthcare is being outsourced. Mm-hmm. Now, that's something that was never done before, but it's possible, and it's going to happen. It's definitely going to happen.
So you say avoid the travel agents, avoid the internet, with the possible exception of Wikipedia.
Well, I don't say avoid the internet. The internet is fantastic, but you know, with the internet, the cost of putting something on there is so low. Anybody can put a website up for as little as $5. So you have to be careful what you read on the internet. I mean, after all, this is really why I wrote a book, because people trust a book. They know that if a book was published by a reputable publishing company, somebody has looked into it, and chances are the material is a little more reliable than just something you read online. Now, I'm a big fan of Wikipedia, but again, you know, people can post anything they like on there. So you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the future, probably what's going to happen with medical tourism is that you'll see services develop that are maybe accredited. They're working on some type of accreditation. Services that are backed up by established medical facilities or other companies. And services that are a lot more transparent. In other words, they say, okay, this is what we're going to charge you. This is where we make the money. You know, we're not just going to take your money and then we'll tell you where we're sending you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll be a lot more open about it. And there'll be a lot of small-time operators that are going to try to cash in, but they'll probably get eventually forced out. And I think the major players will come in because they have the reputation and the services, you know, and the reliability.
Again, it sounds like the most corrupting factor is the facilities paying commissions, and you're going to get that in spades on the internet and to some extent with travel agencies. So we're waiting to see how things evolve, and the book's the best source for now.
Right. I wrote the book in order to provide reliable information, and I discourage people from going on the internet and just using one of those places. I encourage people to contact the hospitals directly. Now, we're seeing some new services that are developing right now that will help you work with the hospitals, and I think that's a wonderful thing. But right now, certainly I would tell people, be careful what you see on the internet. The internet's fantastic, but Anybody can post anything, so don't put any money down until you're pretty sure what you're doing.
One of the ironies about this is you described how sometimes it's easier to get services and surgery in another country than it is in the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if that's ironic. It's the new world that we live in, right? I mean, even our apples come from New Zealand and bottled water comes from France, which is a little absurd when you think about it, but that's the world we live in, right? It's getting smaller.
So if we want to get a facelift in the United States, we have to make all kinds of appointments and screenings and forms. But if we have a passport, we can make a few phone calls, hop on a plane to India, and check into the clinic.
Absolutely. But be sure you know where you're going to. You know, this is the point of the book. It's like, well, you can go to some discount place, and who knows what'll happen. Or you can go to this high, top quality place and get superb service for a fraction of the cost that it would be here. That's really the whole purpose of the book, to show you exactly how to go about it.
Aside from not carefully picking the right facility, what are the biggest mistakes or problems that you see people encounter?
One thing is that they're not prepared. Let's say someone says, I've had weight problems all my life, diets aren't working, this is so frustrating, I'm going to have stomach reduction surgery. Well, okay, here's the problem. They go on the internet, they find all sorts of places that'll offer it, but they don't really understand that there are many different types of the surgeries. They don't understand how they need to prepare for it. They don't understand if they are an appropriate candidate for it, because some of these places on the internet, they just want your money. They're not even going to ask you questions about your medical background. Some people are not suitable candidates for surgery. Some people have more complex diseases, such as diabetes. The real problem is that they're going into this sort of without any preparation and with very little knowledge. And those are the two things that are going to change. And also, those are the two things that are really well discussed in the book. First off, the education, so they know exactly what's going on and what the options are. And the second thing, how to prepare for it, how to prepare before you go, and how to prepare for your return when you really need follow-up care. I think those are the big issues.
So if somebody goes abroad to get their stomach stapled and they've picked a top facility, is that facility going to do a screening process with them while they're still in the United States?
Hopefully they will. Some of them will ask that get certain tests done before you go. For example, you know, for stomach stapling, of course, they should do a preoperative evaluation. And I think a high-quality facility will do that. The other option would be to go there and then have that done there. But then you're sort of flying off without even knowing what's involved, you know, how long it will take and what the pre-op will encounter and all that sort of thing. A top-quality facility will help take care of that, but it still means planning for all that. We see this especially in assisted fertility. As you know, nowadays a lot of women have difficulty conceiving. They've delayed their childbearing maybe because of careers, and they end up being in their late 30s, early 40s even. They want to have a child, but they have some difficulty conceiving. So they opt for IVF, in vitro fertilization, which insurance often, usually, in fact, doesn't cover. And it's very, very expensive. It's usually about $10,000 for each attempt. You might get a package for $30,000 or $40,000 that includes a number of attempts. You can have the same done in Barbados for less than half that cost. And you can have it done in India for much less than that even, maybe one-tenth of the cost. But here again, you need preparatory work. You need to know why there's infertility. And so there are a lot of tests and preparation to be done. And I think the new era that we're heading into is where we're going to see clinics and other services pop up that will help people with that. They'll do the preparatory work for them, and they'll do the follow-up care afterwards.
Well, I think the infertility is a wonderful example of the economics of this. You could get the diagnosis workup done here, probably covered by your insurance. The big savings are when you have a very expensive procedure that isn't covered by insurance. Then the savings are huge. If you're talking about a procedure that's a few thousand dollars that would be covered by insurance here, and it probably is not going to be covered by insurance if you go overseas, then the savings become pretty minimal.
That's right. That's right. And that's an interesting phenomenon, too, about medical tourism, because cost is a driving factor. It's surprisingly not the biggest factor. It turns out that the biggest factor right now for people traveling for healthcare is the quality of healthcare, but cost is definitely a major consideration. But like you say, you know, you're not going to travel overseas to have, say, some fillings put in your teeth. On the other hand, if you need major dental reconstruction, that might cost $10,000
mm-hmm.
here. Well, now that is worth it, right?
Well, especially if it's cosmetic, because the cosmetic's not going to be covered at all.
Absolutely. Dental tourism, by the way, is a very, very big phenomenon. People don't so much go to India for that, because they can go just to Mexico for that. In fact, there's a little town right across the border in Arizona, and the town only has about 1,000 people, but has 250 dentists.
Wow.
And
you could even drive there, too.
1,000 people living there, that's for sure. They're all there right on the border. You know, you can drive right across the border without actually going through the Mexican real border control. They go by the busloads, even. People from Phoenix and other cities, and have their dental care done at a fraction of what it would cost in the U.S.
Which reminds me, another reason that this is so cost-effective is that our medications are often very inflated in the United States. Abroad, they're going to give you medications that they're able to purchase much more inexpensively, and it's the same meds.
Absolutely. This is another factor that a lot of people don't think about, because they could probably pay for their trip just from the savings in medication alone.
To what extent are you allowed to bring that medication back in the U.S.?
Well, the regulations have changed. I don't think they're very much enforced. The regulations used to be that you could bring back a reasonable supply, which, of course, is not defined at all, right?
Right.
So to some people, they would say, well, that means hundreds of pills, and other people might think, well, say a month's supply. Well, the regulations have really tightened up, but I don't think that they're enforced very much. I mean, the customs agent doesn't look through your bottle of pills and say, now, wait a minute. You take this three times a day, so let's count out these pills and see how many days' worth you have here. They're not going to bother with that. It's one thing if you want to bring in medications that are abused, say narcotics or something. That's going to be a different story.
Mm-hmm.
But if you bring in some antibiotic that might cost you an awful lot of money here, you got it for a fraction of the cost overseas, nobody's going to question you. And some of these medications are extremely expensive. I mean, there are medications that cost tens of thousands of dollars. And in that case, if you can get it for a half or a third of the cost overseas, it is well worth it.
And we're going to especially see that with experimental medications and new medications.
Well, that's true, too. As you know, a lot of experimental and newer medications are readily available overseas than they are here.
I want to shift gears to something I know you're very passionate about. Unemployment rates in the U.S. are creeping up, and Americans are freaking out about it. We see the jobs outsourced. There went the manufacturing, there went the tech support, there went the clerical services to India and China, and now healthcare too. Besides the quality of care that we get from outsourcing, what's good about medical outsourcing?
Well, I think it's a little bit of the Walmart effect. As you know, most of the products sold in Walmart are made overseas, especially in China. And people think, well, every time I buy a shirt at Walmart that gets made in China, that's one less shirt that is made in the United States. On the other hand, it also means you can buy a shirt for $8 when otherwise you would have to pay $80 for the shirt. So people, you know, they love and hate Walmart, right? They love the low prices. But they know that that means a lot of the jobs have been outsourced. The way I look at it is that, on the one hand, our quality of life has greatly improved because of outsourcing. You know, we're able to live much better. On the other, certain trades have all but disappeared. And I think that, in the end, what's happening is that we're going to specialize in higher-end products. So it actually makes us stronger. International trade actually makes us stronger. And I think we're going to see the same thing in healthcare, because what will happen is that your family doctor is always going to be there. There will always be a need for a family physician here, because you're not going to go overseas for an earache or something, or a headache or any other kind of smaller problem. But the people who are going to be hurt are the plastic surgeons who are making $500,000 a year, the whole Beverly Hills surgeon types, the radiologists who make $350,000 a year for reading your MRI, which is vastly overpriced, and all of these other procedures that cost a fortune. The number one cause of personal bankruptcy in the United States is health care bills. That's the number one cause of personal bankruptcy. And in fact, the whole housing crisis that we hear about all the time, it turns out that the major reason people can't pay their mortgage is because of health care bills. So those people, they're not suffering because of their family doctors charging them. They're suffering because of the high-end bills. And this is how they can save money, by going overseas. So I think in the end, it's actually going to really help our economy.
I wouldn't have used the Walmart analogy, because when I think of Walmart, I'm wondering whether those sneakers are really as good a quality as the ones I would buy at a regular store. I think the Japanese car industry is a much better example of how they forced Detroit to start producing better quality cars and to drop the idea of planned obsolescence. And that resulted in everybody benefiting from much better cars that were less expensive.
I think you're absolutely right. That is, of course, an excellent example of what happened. In the 1950s, you know, there were the big three car manufacturers in the United States, and they could sell whatever junk they wanted because that's what people bought. And then you got a little phenomenon on the horizon called Volkswagen that came in the 1960s. And then later on, the Japanese car manufacturers, Toyota, Datsun, which became Nissan, and all of these other small companies, and then Hyundai from South Korea, and they really shook up and are still shaking up the American car manufacturers. And you're right. Why did the American car manufacturers not start building the Prius? Why did it take Toyota to do that? I think because they just got too comfortable.
How long do you think it will take for American medicine to respond to the competition and become more accessible, more friendly, more affordable? And how do you think it's going to happen?
Well, it's a good question. It's going to be a little while, because right now medical tourism is barely a blip on the horizon. They're not really seeing the impact yet because the numbers are pretty low. And they're responding by scare stories, right? They try to tell people, mm-hmm. Look, if you go overseas, you're on your own. There's scary things can happen, and we're not going to be there to support you. That's going to go on until people start to see other people go and have very good outcomes, and they'll start to think, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe this isn't such a bad thing. And once it turns into a major phenomenon, which it still is not and probably won't be for a few years, I don't think we're going to see too much change, but I believe that within 5 years, we're suddenly going to start to see that certain hospitals and certain procedures will start falling off here as people go overseas for them. And then we'll see change. And I think the change will be for the better. Of course, we'll have the AMA oppose it, as they've opposed basically everything in healthcare. I mean, they were completely opposed to Medicare when Medicare first came out, because AMA is basically looking out for the interest of the physicians in the U.S. But it's going to happen. And I think the end result is actually going to be good for everyone. It'll make medicine better here as they have some more competition.
So your best guess is a tipping point in about 5 years?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. And my book is actually a bit of a catalyst in that, because my book shows just how well it can be done.
Yeah, you're a troublemaker, let's face it.
Yeah, I am. Well, I'll tell you, I've been in the healthcare services, in virtually every part of healthcare, for about 30 years now. I started out as a paramedic. I worked in medical research. I was an epidemiologist, as you mentioned, medical anthropology, and then eventually I was a country doctor, I was a hospital director, I've worked in emergency rooms. I've done just about every aspect of medicine, and I think our system is so dysfunctional and inefficient, and because of that, a lot of people are suffering. I can't tell you how much it bugs me when I see somebody who is a hard-working person be broken economically because of their health care bills. I just think that's absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what drives me. I just really want to shake up the system.
Now that you've written the book, what are you going to be doing next?
I'm working on my own new medical system called MediCruiser. It is a clinic with house call services, and part of that will be helping people to go overseas. So it'll be the pre-procedural workup and then the post-procedural care when they come back. Next week, I'll be speaking at the first International Medical Tourism Association conference. This is the first international medical tourism conference in the United States, and I'll be talking about this service, and there are a number of other services popping up around the country to do the same thing. So I think we're at the beginning of a big change, and I think it's going to be a very welcome change.
A couple more questions I want to be sure to get in. If you go overseas, you have the medical procedure, you come back to your dermatologist and say, I need some follow-up, are you likely to get, why should I work with you when you just cut me out of my income responses?
Well, that definitely does go on, but eventually it's either they work with you or they don't. It's going to be a matter of only getting part of their business as opposed to none of their business. So I think right now, maybe they have the luxury of turning people away. You know, especially surgeons who say, well, I didn't do your hip replacement, so now why should I take care of you? Because the money's all in the operation itself. I think some of them can get away with saying that now, but in the future, they're going to see that, well, their job will be taking care of people who have gone overseas. So we're going to see a change in that. Other people will step in.
One thing you didn't talk about in the book is nursing homes. I know India is starting to provide very elaborate nursing home services. What do you see as the future for abroad nursing homes?
You're right. I don't discuss that at length in the book. I do refer to it in a few of the chapters on specific countries because I know Malaysia has a big push in that. And in the Caribbean countries and Mexico are also developing that. And I think that's a really fascinating phenomenon. The resistance, of course, is that people want to stay fairly close to home.
Mm-hmm.
But for those who are willing to travel a little bit, you could live at a nursing facility in Mexico much, much less expensively than the same in the United States. So I think we're going to see more of that. That is a fascinating phenomenon.
For tight families that want to visit all the time, that's a real problem. But for people who, you know, I see a lot of people who all their family have died and they're the only ones left, why not?
That's right. And some of them, even if they live in the same city, don't visit more than once every few weeks even.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Mexico once a month just as easily. Now, I think we're also going to see situations where people will be in televideo contact with the people in the nursing homes.
Oh, so, interesting.
This way, you know, you can just touch base that way. And if you can do that, then, of course, the distance doesn't matter. It'll be interesting. It's definitely going to happen in the next few years.
Well, in the televideo you were talking about, it's not Jetson Future. We can do that on our computers now for practically nothing.
That's right. It's basically free if you use something like Skype. And I think people are only just waking up to it.
Book is a starting point, but 2 years from now, how are we going to know whether that facility in Kuala Lumpur is still top-notch? How do we keep up to date? Katrina hits, everybody in the United States knows that facilities aren't as good as they were in New Orleans now, but we don't know what's happening in Kuala Lumpur. How do you keep up on this?
Well, I think that's a really good point. There are pros and cons to writing a book. The pro is that it's hard paper, it's written, it's reliable. The con is that things change quickly, and a book is partly out of date as soon as it's published, and especially in things that change quickly. For example, you know, I discussed Thailand at some length, and right now there are all sorts of political problems in Thailand. I don't actually think that really affects people, but at least there's a perception of it. People right now may be a little leery about going to Thailand, and when I first started writing the book, I had a chapter on Lebanon, and 6 months later, there was a war in Lebanon. So, and there it really did destroy mm-hmm. those facilities. So the answer there is that you go to a reliable website like the Medical Tourism Association's website, and there you get the absolute up-to-date information. So the book will serve more as sort of general advice and say, here's what you need to look for. Here's how you need to prepare. You know, here's how to put your trip together. And then for the latest information, you go on the website, but you go to a reliable website. And for that, I would recommend the Medical Tourism Association.
Is anybody doing a good newsletter or membership?
Yes, they have a magazine.
Oh, wow.
It's all happening very quickly. It's just starting. This industry is in its infancy. We're seeing the very beginnings of it, but it's going to be huge. All the economic indicators say that medical tourism is going to grow tenfold in the next few years.
We've been talking with Dr. Paul Gallinger, author of The Medical Tourism Travel Guide, just a wonderful book. Dr. Gallinger, you have helped so many people by preventing a lot of bad mistakes, helping people get excellent services, save some money, and often have a wonderful vacation at the same time. It's simply wonderful work that you're doing.
Well, I sure hope so.
Thank you for sharing the information and the excitement about this, and really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Commentary. So what can we say about medical tourism? As you probably gathered, I think medical tourism is good for consumers and ultimately good for the American healthcare system. The value to consumers is obvious. Not only do we get more affordable care, but sometimes even better quality care, and usually more patient-friendly care. Indeed, it was mind-blowing to hear Dr. Gallinger describe how, rather than an adversarial process, these facilities just do their best to make it right and don't even charge for it. When I was a kid, there was no dental insurance, no vision insurance. You paid out of pocket, just as we do for groceries and gas and utilities and a lot of other expenses. But today, many Americans have dental insurance and vision insurance, and now they think they have to have it. And it's created a huge bureaucratic overhead that adds to the cost. Insurance should be for expenses that are so large we can't deal with them, such as your house burning down or an auto accident that puts you in a hospital, not for a service contract on a CD player from Radio Shack or sending a package to the post office or routine healthcare expenses. It's ironic that 40 years ago, when we didn't have insurance for vision and dental, there wasn't a lot of competition for eyeglasses. Now we have places like LensCrafters that not only compete very competitively on price, but offer the convenience of making the glasses in an hour. But now that we have vision insurance, companies are saying, oh, sorry, they're not on our plan. We waste so much time and so much money trying to figure out the rules of the system and tracking the payments and the statements and the EOBs. And the eye doctors and the dentists and the physicians and the therapists likewise waste so much time and money trying to navigate the bureaucracy, hiring extra staff just to handle all the paperwork. Now, I'm realistic. Americans aren't going to want to take away the safety net of insurance for routine expenses, unless they're offered something better. The best would be for employers to offer catastrophic health care insurance and give the employees the money saved between the cost of catastrophic insurance and comprehensive insurance and pay that directly to the employee. In other words, you would have a high deductible of several thousand dollars, and unless your expenses reach that point, the catastrophic insurance wouldn't kick in. That policy would cost the employer a lot less, and the employer could pass on the difference to you, and you could spend the money however you wanted to, and that money wouldn't have to pay for all the bureaucratic overheads. To shelter the funds from taxes, the savings are usually passed on through health savings accounts. To me, a health savings account is well-intentioned tax code interfering with choice. It's another bureaucracy, but it's a small one compared to health insurance bureaucracies. Offering just catastrophic health insurance plus health insurance savings accounts isn't some pie-in-the-sky idealistic solution. Large employers are increasingly offering it to employees instead of the traditional arrangements. Employers are happy to get the bureaucracy off their back, and employees are happy to have more control. Why don't employers just skip the health savings accounts and give you the money directly? Well, first there's the trust issue. Then there's the fact that they could, and you could deduct it on your Schedule A, but that assumes you itemize on your taxes, and the IRS disregards the first few thousand dollars of your medical expenses. So the HSAs offer tax savings. One of the growing pains with more choice in healthcare is that when you pay doctors and hospitals out of pocket, you have to negotiate a rate, such as the Medicare rate, or you end up paying the inflated rack price. What a mess. One of the problems with insurance is that deciding what is covered is that it's a very political process. Covering one treatment puts the other treatments at a disadvantage. For example, if you have a back injury, your insurance company will pay for pain pills, muscle relaxants, chiropractors, epidermals, and even surgery. But not for an exercise class, a swimming pool membership, or a treadmill. which, as we learned from Dr. Mark Brown a few weeks ago, would probably do a lot more good at a small fraction of the price. I don't want insurance companies paying for exercise classes, swimming pools, and treadmills. I want people to have the choice of whether to spend their money on pills or treadmills, without having to navigate a bureaucracy and without a bureaucracy imposing a huge middleman overhead. It's about cutting out the middleman and allowing vendors to compete for our business. When medical tourism reaches a tipping point, Dr. Gallinger said he thinks it'll be in about 5 years, it will shake up the healthcare bureaucracies in the United States. Just as the foreign automakers forced Detroit to make better cars, medical tourism will force American healthcare to be more efficient, price competitive, and user-friendly. When the marketplace adjusts to new technologies, new efficiencies, and new consumer demands, there are always some winners and some losers. For the most part, the losers are the providers who stick with their vested interest instead of providing what consumers want and need. The winners tend to be providers who are better at providing what consumers want and need. It's that simple. Of course, there are some charlatans and backroom deals, both in the current system and in the evolving systems. If you're wondering if I'm trying to make a pitch for Republicans or Democrats, the answer's no. Both parties have, time and time again, been supporting the special interest over marketplace competition. Politically, I'm a libertarian. I just like to see the government create a level playing field for competition and get out of the way. I thought about what might help bring medical tourism to the tipping point in the United States. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought Americans really like brand names. Part of it is that Nike logo gives us some prestige and maybe makes us feel special. But part of it is that we see those brand names as a guarantee of a certain level of quality. So if a firm like Johnson & Johnson announced a medical tourism program for hip replacements and other orthopedic surgeries, we would have a lot more confidence in that. If Revlon announces its medical tourism getaways for cosmetic procedures, millions of people would have a lot more confidence in that than going to a place they never heard of. I think it's just a matter of time before cruise lines get heavily involved in medical tourism, not only getting people to the places, but providing the surgery right on the ship while you're taking it easy. Eventually, the HMOs and insurance companies are going to catch on that they can save money, magic words to them, by approving hip resurfacing in India as opposed to the United States, and probably start covering the medical portion of the service. Who knows, maybe they'll feel generous and even give us some travel allowance as well. Or the other countries may bundle the travel expenses in one package deal price. In any case, I think it's just a matter of time before corporate America latches on to this and we see brand names involved in medical tourism. Overall, as we saw with the automotive industry, consumers are the big winners when more responsive, affordable, quality vendors enter the marketplace or the current vendors adapt to better meet our needs. The money that consumers save, by the way, will be available to spend on other goods and services in the marketplace, in effect expanding the GNP, the total quantity of goods and services available to American consumers. Rather than a vote against American jobs, I see medical tourism as a vote for capitalism, competition, and innovation, the ways of doing business that made America so successful. That contrasts with our special interest bloated system that has gotten away from fair and open marketplace competition. I say, bravo, medical tourism. Baby steps. I always try to leave you with some little tweak in your thinking or behavior that will help you live longer and healthier and happier, the purpose of our program. Today's baby step is simply that if you have some upcoming medical expenses that are large expenses, especially if they are out-of-pocket expenses, consider the option of medical tourism. The two starting tools are Dr. Gallinger's book, The Medical Tourism Travel Guide, and the Medical Tourism Association's website, which is simply medicaltourismassociation.com. I'll also put that on my website, agelesslifestyles.com. Their monthly magazine is free, and I think this nascent organization is going to become a great source of information. Emails! Love getting those emails! Most of the emails on our program last week, How to Survive a Nursing Home Stay, were very appreciative of the empowerment that I encouraged. A few, however, raised concerns about retaliation. Remember Nurse Ratched in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? McMurphy, played by Jack Nicholson, challenged Nurse Ratched's authority and was rewarded with a lobotomy. If you complain about a nurse or a nurse's aide, I guarantee you, you won't get a lobotomy. That procedure is pretty uncommon these days. But what's to keep the staff member, or even butting up with her other staff members, from being surly, passive-aggressive, or even rough when putting in that IV? It is a risk. In my experience, most staff don't retaliate. Those that do usually make a mental calculation of whether they can get away with it. Consequently, it is usually the most vulnerable patients, patients who are not good at expressing themselves and don't have a family member or advocate speaking on their behalf. They're the ones that usually get the retaliation, if any. When a staff member senses that you or your advocates are determined to get good service, they rarely retaliate. When I have seen retaliation, it is usually a very immature aide who was destined to get fired sooner or later. If they are retaliating, sooner is much better, and I have no sympathy for them becoming unemployed. The bottom line is the few staff members who are inclined to retaliate tend to pick the most vulnerable patients, and they usually control themselves with patients whom they think will continue to insist on good treatment and take action if they don't get it. As I said, I love getting emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. I would like to note that I have been invited to speak at an exclusive speaking platform for the public to learn about health and wellness. The seminars are free and feature leading national and international experts on health and wellness, many of them names that you'll recognize immediately. My seminar will give a good overview of my anti-aging ABCs, the attitudes, beliefs, and coping skills for living longer, healthier, and happier. Mark your calendar for October 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time to hear my seminar. The site has many other seminars by well-renowned experts that you'll want to hear as well. All are free, but you do have to register at healthteleclass.com. That's healthteleclass.com. And if you don't have a pencil handy, I'll also have that link on agelesslifestyles.com. This is anti-aging psychologist Dr. Michael Bricke with Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. Shows are archived at agelesslifestyles.com. That's agelesslifestyles.com, as are links mentioned on shows. You can also go to notaging.com, simply notaging.com. That's my portal site for all my services, such as subscribing to my newsletter, speaking services, personal coaching services, books, hypnosis CDs, and anti-aging information. Until next week, thank you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, happier lives.